The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Facebook will not refriend Donald Trump. That's just one account, though. Critics want to know, has the company dealt with its underlying problems?
They created loopholes for hate speech, incitement to violence, all kinds of things that Trump engaged in.
Also, Scotland goes to the polls tomorrow with a lot at stake. Will it stay in the UK or go it alone?
It's extremely divisive. It's divided this nation down the middle.
The U.S. Secretary of State is in Ukraine, visiting a key American ally.
Ukraine's on the front line of attacks that the Russians have been making, but a wide range of aggression.
And a Swedish lawmaker strives to preserve this ancient language. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Some big news this afternoon in the global fight against the coronavirus. The Biden administration says it supports waiving intellectual property protections for COVID vaccines. This would allow drug companies in other countries to make vaccines using formulas developed by American pharmaceutical companies. The U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai released a statement today saying that this is a global health crisis and the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic call for extraordinary measures. At the same time, the statement also underscored the White House's strong support generally for intellectual property protections. Joining me now is The World's Ilana Gordon, who covers public health for the show. Ilana, what does this mean that the U.S., the Harris and Biden administration, is supporting waiving patents?
So, Marco, as you said, this is a really big shift. It's big news. It's rare that a patent is waived. They're protected under rules that were established through the World Trade Organization in the 90s. There's some specific exceptions, but it's super difficult, like legally and politically. And the global system is fiercely protected. It's developers of a product that control the patent and who can use it. And so the shift means that there's been this growing push during the pandemic to lift COVID-19 patents. It's been a big debate, but the idea is that governments, companies, manufacturers around the world shouldn't need permission. They can't afford to wait to get on board to make vaccines and make them more accessible because there's just such a limited supply.
So with about a minute, Ilana, what happens next?
So any final decisions to change WTO trade rules require consensus. South Africa and India had brought this waiver proposal to the table last fall. Now it's in negotiations. So the waiver hasn't been approved, but U.S. leadership has said, yes, we're on board to negotiate and make this work. Now the question is in the details and how soon something like this can translate to more vaccines and supplies around the globe.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much for this update.
Thanks, Marco.
Facebook unfriended a big one today, or to get the lingo more accurate, they did not refriend someone. Former President Donald Trump is not welcome back on Facebook, at least not for now. Earlier today, an independent board that reviews Facebook's big decisions on content and accounts said Trump's ban will stand. The World's Lydia Manalidou reports that what happens next could have a big impact beyond U.S. borders.
Back when Trump was still active on social media, he'd often fire off things that made jaws drop around the world. He posted conspiracy theories, insulted heads of state, and even kind of threatened nuclear war against North Korea. Facebook and other companies resisted calls to rein in the U.S. president. They argued that because Trump was a public figure, his statements were newsworthy and that the public had a right to see them.
The big problem is they created loopholes for hate speech, incitement to violence, all kinds of things that Trump engaged in.
Heidi Beirich is with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She says Facebook has held political figures to a different set of rules, and Trump was by no means the only one taking advantage of that.
There are so many world leaders, extremists, and far-right populists who took all of that and used it to their advantage to demonize and harm vulnerable populations in various countries. This is the tragedy of the loopholes that were created for Trump.
She says one example is India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who used those same loopholes to demonize the country's minority populations.
The Filipino leader, Duterte, has also used those exceptions
to go after political figures and journalists. Here in the U.S., the tide started to turn for Trump during the 2020 election, when he was using social media to push conspiracy theories and lies about election fraud.
We had an election that was stolen.
The final straw for Facebook was this video the former president posted on his account after his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol in January.
So go home. We love you.
Facebook's decision to cut off Trump from 35 million followers on Facebook and 24 million on Instagram was really controversial. And it wasn't just Republicans who complained about it. An independent Facebook oversight board reviewed that decision over the past few months. Its members include a former prime minister of Denmark, a Nobel laureate from Yemen, and human rights activists from Pakistan and Taiwan. Heidi Beirich says she finds today's decision a bit disappointing.
They basically kicked the can back to Facebook.
But not indefinitely. It's giving Facebook 6 months to reassess the penalty. Beirich says one part of the decision she finds encouraging is that the oversight panel is asking Facebook to clarify its rules for influential accounts, like those of politicians.
But the irony is that Facebook is the one that created this convoluted mess in the first place. Can we be sure that they're actually going to fix it? I think that's the big question here.
And there's an even bigger issue, says Corey Kreider with the London-based tech accountability nonprofit Foxglove.
The reality is that this whole kerfuffle over Donald Trump is essentially a distraction.
She says it's a distraction from all the other problematic posts Facebook is failing to address from across the world. She points to recent harassment and disinformation campaigns by political leaders and parties in Azerbaijan and Honduras.
And because Azerbaijan doesn't grab the headlines the way that Donald Trump has done so skillfully for several years, Facebook just didn't pay any attention to it.
Facebook says it does pay attention to what goes on its platforms all over the world, and that it's hired more people with the language skills and cultural knowledge to moderate content in different countries. But Kreider says the company's still not doing enough, and today's decision from the Oversight Board, which demands accountability from Facebook, is a reminder of that. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Biden's Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, today. His stated mission, to, quote, reaffirm unwavering U.S. support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity in the face of Russia's ongoing aggression, end quote. Last month, Russia built up tens of thousands of troops along Ukraine's border. A year and a half ago, Ukraine was on the minds of many Americans as they watched the first impeachment hearing of President Trump. Let's listen back here to former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor.
Ukraine is a strategic partner of the United States, important for the security of our country, as well as Europe. Ukraine is on the front line in the conflict with a newly aggressive Russia.
William Taylor joins us today to talk about Ukraine and Russia. Taylor is now the Vice President of Strategic Stability and Security at the United States Institute of Peace. Ambassador Taylor, first of all, why is Ukraine such an important priority for the United States?
Ukraine's important to the United States for a couple of reasons. One is Ukraine is on the front line of attacks that the Russians have been making, first against Ukraine, then against Europe, and against the United States. Not just the military attacks now we're talking about. We're talking about a wide range of aggression. And just think about election meddling. The Russians meddled in Ukrainian elections in 2014. I was there observing them. They meddled in elections and referenda and Brexit in Europe. And in 2016, as we know, and in 2020, the Russians meddled in our elections. All to say that the Russians seem to start in Ukraine, but they don't stop there. That's why Ukraine is an important country for us. It's on the front line.
So today, Secretary Blinken will meet with his counterpart, Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, and also Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. If you were in Blinken's shoes, Ambassador, what would your message be?
My message would be, we, the United States, we support Ukrainian sovereignty. And what that means is we will support Ukraine as it defends itself against Russian incursion, attacks on that sovereignty, which they, of course, have done. The Russians have invaded militarily Ukraine, first in Crimea, then in the southeastern part of Ukraine called Donbass. First time that any nation in Europe has attacked another nation with the idea of changing the border since World War II. So this is serious that the United States supports Ukraine in opposing that aggression. And if it were me, I would say that the United States will go beyond mere statements.
And what would that active role look like when you say beyond? Like when Blinken says, if Russia crosses that line, the U.S. will respond. What could that mean?
One thing that could clearly mean is what was embedded in the phone call that President Biden put into President Putin 3 weeks ago, that President Putin should back down all of his military forces that were and still are on the border of Ukraine. And he said, by the way, President Biden also told President Putin that in 2 days, we're going to put more sanctions on you. And sure enough, 2 days later, the United States did. And then the third thing, President Biden suggested that they might want to get together with the clear implication that if Mr. Putin were to invade Ukraine, that summit would be off and other things would happen. There would be more sanctions. And the Russian government knows that the sanctions already imposed on Russia and its economy are not the end of the road on sanctions. There are more sanctions, more dramatic, painful sanctions that would come.
Knowing what we know about Putin, though, Mr. Ambassador, I mean, sanctions and summit cancellations don't seem like it would necessarily change his behavior.
You know, Marco, I'm not sure that's true. I will argue that sanctions have changed his behavior. At the beginning, in 2014, a lot of people were concerned that President Putin might go further, might not stop at invading Crimea. He might not stop at invading Donbass. There was talk about invading all the way to Kyiv, all the way to the capital of Ukraine. They didn't do that. Why? I think because sanctions came on. So Mr. Putin's behavior has been affected, I believe. I believe he's been constrained against going further into Ukraine. And indeed, part of that sanction effort that has changed his behavior is knowing that there are more and harsher sanctions to come.
So I hear some optimism there. If there is further escalation, is there a scenario, Mr. Ambassador, in which you can imagine boots on the ground?
I can only imagine Ukrainian boots on the ground. Hmm. The Ukrainian military was in terrible shape in 2014 when the Russians invaded. That has changed. Ukrainian military today is, as they say, battle-tested. The Ukrainian military has been fighting the Russian military, a formidable foe, for 7 years. The Ukrainian military has boots that are on the ground, on the front line, but also across the country, that would oppose the Russian invasion strongly. Now, let's be clear. Strong and as improved as the Ukrainian military is, it's no match for the full onslaught of the Russian military if that were what would happen. But it would be very painful. I mean, Mr. Putin knows that the Russian people are not behind, would not support an invasion of Ukraine.
Ambassador, what does this moment represent in terms of opportunity to get Putin's attention and just budge him away from whatever aggressive moves he might have on his mind?
Marco, I think you're right. This is an opportunity. President Putin wants to be seen as a major player on the world stage. A summit with the President of the United States would certainly indicate that he's a major player. So this gives President Biden some leverage to nudge him in the direction of a more responsible player. You know, there's nothing threatening about NATO. There is no interest in further worsening of tensions between the United States and Russia. If the Russians will stop invading their neighbors, stop meddling in elections, stop poisoning people, will stop human rights violations, there is an opportunity. And President Putin could take that opportunity to move toward a more responsible player. And President Biden has some leverage to do that.
William Taylor is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, speaking with us about what's at stake with Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit today to Kyiv. Ambassador Taylor, thank you very much for your time.
Marco, thanks for having me.
New data confirm what we've been hearing anecdotally. Asian American hate crimes have risen sharply in the United States, more than doubling in the first 3 months of 2021 compared with last year. That's according to new research from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino. Hate crimes are defined as criminal acts motivated by race, religion, or sexual orientation. The study looked at 16 jurisdictions with significant Asian American populations. One reason cited for the surge in incidents, the pandemic, specifically politicians blaming China for the coronavirus outbreak, stigmatizing and hurtful language like the Chinese virus and Kung flu used by President Trump and others.
Asian Americans are more concerned about other Americans' hate than they are of a pandemic that's killed 500,000 people.
Russell Jung is a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. He also co-founded the organization Stop AAPI Hate, which tracks experiences of abuse reported by Asian Americans.
1 out of 5 Stop AAPI Hate respondents now display signs of racial trauma. That's long-term elevated symptoms of depression, anxiety, avoidance, and hypervigilance. That's the hallmark of trauma.
Jung classifies hate into 4 categories: civil rights violations, online harassment, microaggressions, and physical assaults. The World recently moderated a panel on anti-Asian hate that Russell Jung was a part of. Panelists also pointed to the long history of racism against Asians and Asian Americans in the U.S., the treatment of Chinese immigrants in California during that state's 19th century gold rush, federal laws putting strict quotas on the numbers of Asian immigrants admitted to the U.S., Japanese Americans placed in internment camps during World War II. Panelist Juliet Choi offered some solutions. She's president and CEO of the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum and said more AAPI voices need to be heard in both corporate America and at all levels of government.
Making sure if your table is big enough that it includes our perspective and our voices from the beginning, not after a crisis. And that is low-hanging fruit.
To hear more about this, head over to theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. That's where you can watch a video of the entire discussion. Again, that's theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Just ahead on the show, one town's fight to save a language from extinction. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's 1,000 feet long, weighs 70,000 tons, and is extremely powerful. I'm talking about China's high-tech aircraft carrier, the Shandong, which just became operational. This week, the carrier is conducting war games in the South China Sea, a disputed zone claimed by China as well as 5 other countries. The World's Patrick Nguyen says the mission has drawn furious reaction from officials in the region. So, Patrick, why is this Chinese aircraft carrier coming to the South China Sea such a big deal?
Marco, aside from nuclear warheads, this aircraft carrier is China's most powerful weapon. And now it's making its official debut in some of the most disputed waters on Earth, which is the South China Sea. Parts of the sea are claimed by other countries that are touching the sea. Vietnam and the Philippines are the main ones. And now China is sending this giant floating fortress into those contested waters to say, "This is mine." This is why China has been building aircraft carriers like this. It's actually the first one that is 100% designed by China. It's really impressive. Mm. And it sends a message to America as well, because America has been sending its aircraft carriers to the South China Sea to say, no, these waters do not just belong to China. And now, for the first time in history, the U.S. and China are both circulating aircraft carriers in that sea. So that's why this is important.
So how have neighboring countries reacted to this?
Yeah, officials in Southeast Asia are never happy to see China showing off its power in the sea because they know their navies are relatively tiny compared to China's. But as far as reactions go, the foreign minister of the Philippines, Teddy Lacson, he just kind of lost it on Twitter, saying, quote, "China, my friend, how politely can I put it? Let me see. Get the F out." He
wow.
also called China an ugly oaf. Yeah.
So does this mean China and the Philippines are on the brink of some serious clash?
It would sound like it was leading towards that, but actually, no. The foreign minister, Teddy Lacson, he had to apologize to China very promptly. He also got reprimanded by the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, who actually said through a spokesman, "Hold on, I'm the only official in this cabinet who is allowed to curse." Mm. So, in other words, it got buried very quickly. And everybody could see where the real power lies. It's not on Twitter. It's with military strength. It's risky to talk that way to China.
Speaking of risky, let me pick up on a point you made a moment ago, Patrick. This is the first time the U.S. and China are circulating aircraft carriers in the same disputed zone. How risky is that?
Well, they try to time it such that the aircraft carriers are not there at the same time. At least it looks like that's what they're going to do. America's was there semi-recently. China moved its new aircraft carrier in when America was not in the area. So you just don't want them to be near each other at all, but increasingly it looks like that's going to be inevitable.
You know, we keep seeing these ominous headlines about the South China Sea, China sowing what seems to be some fairly aggressive oats. What is next for the South China Sea and this powerful Chinese aircraft carrier?
Yeah, well, in the South China Sea, you're going to increasingly see China deploy this aircraft carrier, the Shandong. When the aircraft carrier isn't there, there's this shadow naval militia, these so-called Chinese fishing boats that often have armed men on board. The Philippine government actually calls them a militia directly. Hundreds of these boats have been swirling near Philippine territory, territory claimed by the Philippines recently, and that's part of what upset the foreign minister so much. Mm. As for the Shandong, this aircraft carrier, it has already taken a spin around the other big flashpoint in Asia, which is Taiwan. That will keep happening. To quote one Chinese general, our aircraft carriers are, quote, not homebodies, and long-distance voyages will become normal.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much for explaining this.
Thanks, Marco.
Language is about more than just words. Embedded in language are traditions and cultures that go back thousands of years. This is something that a town in Sweden is well aware of. People there are working to preserve an ancient language called Älvdalen. Here with that story is The World's Bianca Hillier.
The small town of Älvdalen offers the same idyllic scenery found throughout Sweden. There's a river nearby and lush Swedish forests at every turn. But the town's native tongue, Älvdalen, doesn't sound anything like the national language.
The lexicon, the vocabulary, is as far from Swedish as Icelandic.
That's linguist Yair Sapir, who knows Älvdalen well. To show just how different it is to Swedish, I asked him to say the same sentence in both languages. In Älvdalen,
Ig yxer över uvändes viktigt bevara älvdalsku.
And in Swedish,
Jag tycker det är mycket viktigt att bevara älvdalskan.
In English, by the way, that means I think it is very important to preserve Älvdalen. Preservation is vital at this point. Älvdalen has been losing speakers at a concerning rate for about 100 years now. It initially came under threat as people traveled around the country more. Swedish began to take over, and Älvdalen was stigmatized.
My parents spoke Älvdalen with each other and with my grandma and with my aunts and uncles and everybody around. But when they turned to me, they spoke Swedish.
Ulla Schut was born in Älvdalen. She says her parents spoke Swedish with her because that's what was spoken in schools. Students were even discouraged to speak Älvdalen in the classroom. Now, there's only about 2,500 speakers left. Schut is part of an organization working to change that trend. It's called Ulumdalska.
And it means, let us speak Älvdalen.
Bjorn Rienström is part of the team. He helps run Älvdalen lessons on Facebook.
Brinden gick fram stugan.
That's Rienström teaching members how to say, the moose went to the cottage in Älvdalen. 1,800 students are paying attention from around the world. Some have connections to the region, and some are just language nerds.
America, Australia, South America, Indonesia, Haiti, Cap Verde. People read it. People are saying that they want to go to Älvdalen and help the language to survive.
That support warms Rienström's heart because Älvdalen is at risk of dying out. The language does have backing from the local government, which helps, for example, by paying for signs that say, Welcome to Älvdalen in Älvdalen. But the national government is a different story. They consider Älvdalen a dialect of Swedish, not a language. Swedish MP Peter Helander recently asked in Parliament why that's the case, in Älvdalen.
Det här är älvdalska, alltså en spillra av fornnordiska som vi har kvar i Sverige. Och,
before the culture minister could answer the question, the parliamentary speaker interrupted.
Tack så mycket, och jag vill påminna ledamoten att språket i kammaren är svenska.
She said only Swedish may be spoken in the chamber, no other languages. MP Helander says the speaker's mistake proves his point that Älvdalen should be considered its own language. Ulla Schut from Älvdalen says getting this accreditation is key.
if we get a recognition, it would be a lot easier to get into the school system. And if we are going to succeed with our goals to revitalize our language, we have to teach our younger generation.
Schutt says losing Elfdalian would be a major loss.
It's a part of our identity. It's a part of our culture. And if part of your culture and your identity dies, the part of yourself dies.
Schutt says she and others will continue to fight to make sure that doesn't happen to Elfdalian, the forest language that the small town of Elfdalen is proud to call their own. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll be right back. You're with The World. Geothermal energy, huge in Iceland, but a tiny energy source in Latin America. Its potential there could be much bigger.
We have more than 3,000 volcanoes, so you can imagine that there's a lot of energy there. We could definitely harness much more.
Investing to harness geothermal energy is heating up. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Holidays in Europe may soon be an option again. Ambassadors from across the EU met today to discuss plans to reopen Europe's borders to tourists. The EU Commission's president, Ursula von der Leyen, tweeted that it's time to revive the EU tourism industry. But as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, when infections globally are still rampant, that's a complex order.
For 15 years, Mark Gauci dreamed of opening a hotel on the island of Malta, where he grew up. In 2019, he made it happen. The following year, Gauci's hotel, called The Barrister, was named the top place to stay in Malta's capital, Valletta, by a popular booking website. But then the pandemic hit.
Within less than 3 weeks, I think, we ended up having to close. And we ended up having to close because we had zero guests in house. It was disappointing, is not the word. I mean, it was shell-shocking.
Malta is hugely dependent on tourism, but like the rest of the EU, there's been an almost blanket ban for tourists from outside of Europe for about a year. Then this week, the EU Commission recommended that the continent starts to open its doors to non-EU visitors. Gauci welcomes the news, but he says everyone in the industry now has to play their part.
It is a chain, so there's no point in trying to invite people over if services aren't going to be available or there's not going to be enough flights. It needs to be a concentrated effort.
The EU is proposing that vaccinated tourists from countries with low infection rates would be welcome starting in the summer. But there's a catch. The vaccines must be EU approved.
At the first moment, it looked like, oh my God, that means everybody can come except the Chinese, because the Chinese vaccine has not been yet approved by the EU.
Wolfgang Georg Arlt is a professor with the China Outbound Tourism Research Institute in Germany. When he heard the news, he wasn't happy. But then,
lo and behold, a couple of hours later, there was also the news that now the European Health Administration has started the approval process for the Chinese vaccine.
Arlt reckons by the time the EU approves the Chinese vaccine, Europe's borders will just be opening up. That's important for business. After Americans, visitors from China make up the greatest number of tourists in Europe. But Arlt says it might not be that easy to get the Chinese to come back to the continent.
I think actually at the moment it is not so much that we have to be afraid of the Chinese, rather that the Chinese are afraid of us.
Europe is still struggling to contain the third wave of the virus, while China appears to have it pretty much under control. The EU's longer-term plan is to introduce digital green certificates for all travellers. This would mean tourists could also visit EU countries if they can produce a negative COVID test result or proof of immunity. British travel consultant Paul Charles says the certificates are essential if the tourism industry is to survive the summer.
There have to be options for travelling. There can't be mandatory vaccine certificates because there are those who won't have had a vaccine. It's vital that countries make it as easy as possible to enable travellers to get through the borders.
But don't book your flight to Paris just yet. The recommendations are still just that, recommendations. and each EU country can decide which tourists to let in and who to turn away. Paul Charles says, do your research before you get on the plane.
You're going to need to be a bit of a detective, a bit of a sleuth, to work out which countries are going to let you in more easily than others. Not every country is going to open up overnight, and it's going to be a challenging few weeks.
Challenge or not, Maltese hotel owner Mark Gauci says after the roller coaster of the last year, this week's announcement is a glimmer of hope for people in the European tourism industry. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, he tells me. Now let's just hope it doesn't go out again. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Maybe you're looking to take that European getaway to the UK. For you history buffs, the border between Scotland and England is full of interesting stuff. Centuries ago, the borderlands were a lawless place, roaming bandits and feuding clans. These days, things are peaceful, but the political temperature is rising. Scots narrowly rejected independence from the UK a few years back. Now, pro-independence parties are expected to take a majority in tomorrow's Scottish parliamentary elections. And back on that border, things get complicated. Andrew Connolly reports from the village of Coldstream.
Coldstream used to host shotgun weddings for runaway English couples who could get married just over the border in Scotland without parental approval. But lately it's the prospect of a divorce from England that looms over this ancient frontier town, the inescapable question of Scottish independence. On a sunny spring afternoon, Malcolm Campbell tries to snare a salmon or a trout in the River Tweed. And on the other side, England.
It's a nice day to be fishing, but it's you're just not going to catch much.
For almost as long as he's been fishing, Malcolm has been dreaming of an independent Scotland, and his views have only hardened since Brexit and Boris Johnson. Most Scots don't like and didn't vote for either.
The UK government. I mean, Boris Johnson and his pals. Bad news.
Polls suggest that pro-independence parties could gain a narrow majority in the Scottish Parliament on Thursday, keeping the issue of a second referendum on the agenda. But Boris Johnson says the matter is settled and he will refuse to grant permission for a second one, whatever the election result. In that case, Malcolm thinks Scotland could take a page out of Catalonia's book in 2017.
So when you said, like, just go for it like Spain, you basically mean like a...
Yeah, wildcat.
A wildcat unsanctioned referendum.
Yeah.
Back then, the Spanish government called Catalonia's referendum illegal and imprisoned their leaders. The Scottish government says they'll seek a referendum legally, going to court if necessary. The ruling party has also pledged to rejoin the European Union after independence, but some people in Coldstream fear that could create a hard border with England.
So we actually have a population that straddles the border.
John Greenwell served in the British Army around the world before moving to Coldstream 12 years ago. He's now a local Conservative Party councillor.
Families have got people that live in Cornhill, which is only a mile down the road, which is in England. And we have business people that live in England but have their business here in Coldstream.
With a little over 100,000 people, the Borders is one of Scotland's most rural and sparsely populated areas. In the 2014 referendum, support for independence was strong in central Scotland, but here it was opposed by around two-thirds of voters, many of whom feel alienated by the movement.
It would mean that our members of our family, and me in particular, I have family that live in and work in England, would they suddenly become foreigners to us? So there are a number of issues that that are on people's minds, and currency, I think, probably would be one of the top ones, family another one, and you know, it's the unknown, it's stepping into the unknown, I think, that worries people, especially when we are so close to the border.
For the last 20 years, Scotland's Parliament has been given increasing autonomy to legislate over areas like the economy, education, policing and taxation. Throughout the pandemic, Scotland has sometimes diverged from UK lockdown policy, and the government briefly closed its border to non-essential travel from England. Some might argue a border of sorts is already in place, though some prime ministers disagree.
I would point out to my honourable friend what he knows very well, there is no such thing as a border between England and Scotland.
Yeah, elbow nudge, isn't it? Yeah. I'm looking forward to when handshakes will come back.
Retired friends John Reed, Will Murray and Trevor Swan form part of the Coldstream Historical Society. They vividly recount the village's proximity to blood-soaked battles between Scotland and England, as well as its solid Union credentials, like the iconic red-uniformed and bearskin-hatted Coldstream Guards. They're the soldiers seen guarding Buckingham Palace. John says that despite the enduring differences thrown up by the river border, the community gets on fine.
We've lived cheek by jowl for centuries, and intermarriage is commonplace. And yet, this side of the border is fiercely Scottish in its traditions and customs, as is the other side of the border, fiercely English in its traditions and customs. Remember, we're only a stone's throw away, approximately a stone's throw away, and despite the passage of centuries, that remains the same.
But inevitably, the topic of independence bubbles to the surface. Will is a proud Scottish nationalist and doesn't see the threat of a border.
I mean, just need to look at Ireland as an example.
Well, look at the mess it's in.
John is more sceptical and sees too much risk. Trevor, born just a mile away in England, sits on the fence.
If somebody can say to me, this will definitely not happen, and we'll definitely have a currency that is worth something, that can be supported...
Can I say that to you? Can I say that to you?
Aye, but you have to back it up.
Just promising, I'll guarantee it.
See, that's the other thing about what I dislike intensely, is the whole issue is divisive. And it is a live issue in Scotland. It's extremely divisive. It's divided this nation down the middle.
So did Brexit.
Kirsty Hughes is the director of the Scottish Centre on European Relations, an independent think tank. She says that a border will be inevitable if Scotland joins the EU, but Scots and English probably won't have to show their papers to cross it.
I don't think it will reach that stage, because what everybody, or almost everybody, expects at the moment is that an independent Scotland would be part of something called the Common Travel Area, which at the moment encompasses the UK and the Republic of Ireland. And that means British and Irish citizens have the right to travel freely to each other's countries, to live there, to work there, even to vote there.
But would EU membership make up for the potential trade disruption with England?
So to make an economic case for independence, you've also got to set out what the plus points are and how you'd run economic policy differently, how you might restructure your economy over time, aim to export more to Europe compared to Britain and so on and so on. And I think what's quite surprising in the Scottish debate is the lack of such studies.
But Malcolm Campbell just thinks that the status quo is unfair, with Scotland's 5 million people at the mercy of political decisions made by its much larger neighbour, England. And if a border is the cost of independence, then so be it.
So we don't stand a chance. It's not a union of equals. So the United Kingdom is not a union of equals.
With important technical detail often drowned out by emotional appeals to sovereignty, the comparisons with Brexit are inevitable. And soon, the tranquil borderlands may be just the latest flashpoint in a world driven by binary choices. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly, in the Scottish Borders.
Geothermal is a renewable energy source that involves drilling for hot steam deep underground. According to the UN, less than 10% of the global potential for geothermal energy is being tapped. If that changes, it could help many countries' energy demands without contributing to global warming. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Global geothermal capacity has nearly doubled since 2000, and interest is ticking up across the planet. The World's Anacostia reports on one region where that's especially true, Latin America.
Geothermal right now provides less than 1% of the world's energy. The largest concentration of geothermal is in the U.S. Then comes Indonesia, the Philippines, and Turkey. When Enrique Porras got his start in the industry, he worked at a plant in Nicaragua that was one of the first in Latin America.
I was supervisor of welding pipelines in the field, you know, spend the days solving problems. And if there are no problems, that's not fun. We need to solve some problems.
He's not in the field solving problems anymore. Now, he helps expand the number of geothermal projects in Latin America, coordinating international projects for ORMAT, a geothermal company based in the U.S.
We have plants in Guatemala, Honduras, and Buyan, which is in Guadeloupe, at the Caribbean.
And this one in southern Guatemala, where huge green pipes carry steam created underground by the molten core of the earth. to dozens of turbines above ground that spin as hot air blows through them. The turbines harness that steam to create electricity. Right now, there are more than a dozen geothermal power plants running in Latin America, stretching from Mexico to Chile to the Caribbean. They produce less than 1% of the region's energy needs, but there's potential for a lot more.
We have more than 3,000 volcanoes all over Latin America and the Caribbean. So you can imagine that there's a lot of energy there. We could definitely harness much more.
Christian Gishler Blanco is an energy specialist at the Inter-American Development Bank. He says where there are volcanoes, that means heat from the earth is a lot closer to the surface, making geothermal exploration and drilling much easier.
If you remember those maps that talk about the ring of fire, that basically there is a fault and that goes all the way from Alaska to Chile.
And tracing a path along the west coast of Latin America.
There are areas where you will have a lot of potential sources of heat.
There are around 150 projects in development currently, 10 times more than exists now. And interest is growing from international development funders like the World Bank and others. There's a lot to like about geothermal, says Gishler. For one, it's more reliable than alternatives, like solar, which needs the sun to shine, or hydropower, which needs rivers to flow.
When there is a hurricane in the Caribbean or in Central America, you have damages to wind farms, to solar farms, but nothing happens to geothermal.
Geothermal plants are also an easy transition for former oil workers, says Porras with Ormat.
Any petroleum engineer, people involved in exploration on oil and gas, can easily go to geothermal. The difference are pretty small, but the basics are the same.
Porras says when the price of oil drops,
then we get a lot of CVs and people wanted to work with us.
Right now, Latin America gets more than a quarter of its energy from renewable sources. Geothermal could help boost that even higher, says Jamie Beard, who heads the Geothermal Entrepreneurship Organization based at the University of Texas.
Geothermal has been the forgotten renewable. Globally, it has been vastly underrecognized, underappreciated, and not well developed.
Geothermal energy requires a lot of upfront funding for exploration. A power plant can cost tens of millions of dollars to build, and it could be 10, 15 years before it turns a profit. And the remote locations of most geothermal resources often means expanding the grid, another expensive proposition. The World Bank has said that with between $2 and $3 billion, geothermal in the region could produce nearly 800 megawatts of electricity, enough to power more than half of Mexico City. Investment to support geothermal has been increasing around the world. Geothermal capacity has nearly doubled globally in the last 20 years, says Jamie Beard.
There's a lot of interest from the Biden administration on jobs and skills transfer from the oil and gas industry. There's a renaissance happening right now for geothermal, and that's largely related to the oil and gas industry starting to engage and make investments in the space.
A renaissance in Latin America is also what Gishler at the Inter-American Development Bank is hoping for.
The real goal here is to go towards the decarbonization of the continent. That's the real goal. Now, how do we get there quickly?
In the near term, geothermal is not going to produce as much energy as solar or wind. But advocates say with targeted investment, it could play a role in phasing out fossil fuels. For the World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
NASA's Hubble telescope has just sent back a photo of a giant blue star. Scientists say this star expands and contracts and can even explode its own outer layers. To see images of this amazing astronomical phenomenon, head to our Instagram page. That's theworld.org/Instagram. In India, COVID has led to the death of more than a quarter of a million people. The health system can't keep up. In the coming days, several Indian states will go into complete lockdown to help slow the spread. Many Indians are calling out Prime Minister Narendra Modi for negligence and mismanagement during the pandemic. Modi has been popular, but the pandemic response could cost him politically. To find out how, we turn to Milan Vaishnav. He's a senior fellow and director of the South Asia Program of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and joins us now from Washington. Milan, India's health system is overwhelmed. People can't get the oxygen they need. We're seeing crematoriums that are working around the clock. When critics point the finger at Prime Minister Modi, what are they saying he's responsible for specifically?
Well, you have to remember that this is India's second bout with COVID. India was relatively less affected than many other richer, better resource countries. And so I think that fed a sense of complacency. The government sounded a note of triumphalism that, unlike many other countries in the West, India actually figured out how to defeat the coronavirus. And so India has now been hit with a massive second wave. And I think a lot of people are pointing the finger at Mr. Modi to say, you let us down. You didn't use this lull between the first and second wave to prepare. So we have not only a shortage of hospital beds, of ICU rooms, but, you know, basic life-saving care like oxygen. So many people who are dying today in India are actually dying preventable deaths.
So does the actual data show that Modi could have done more?
Well, I think what we know is as follows. We know that the government had set up a COVID-19 task force that had stopped meeting. We know that the prime minister, members of his cabinet, had spent much of the early months of this year campaigning for key state elections, which have just rounded up last week. And we know that people from the prime minister on down were signaling a return to normalcy, the idea that the economy could get going again, people could go back, that they didn't have to worry. We even had people in the cabinet saying you didn't have to wear masks anymore.
So the human stories right now and images of what's happening in India, it's really devastating. How will this crisis in India's healthcare system actually affect Prime Minister Modi politically? What are you already seeing?
I think there's no doubt that the extent of outrage, particularly among those who live in urban environments in cities and towns and who belong to India's middle classes, is the highest it's been since Modi came to power back in 2014. However, I think we need to be really cautious in extrapolating from that how it might affect Modi's broader political fortunes. You know, general elections in India are not scheduled until 2024, so a lot can happen between now and then. Modi still remains, despite his shortcomings, the most popular political leader in India, head and shoulders above members of the opposition. And the other thing we know about Mr. Modi is that he is incredibly politically resilient. He is, I would describe him as the master of reinvention. And so I think the jury is still out in terms of how this is going to hurt him in terms of his hold on national power.
I'm curious, how has Modi weathered other political storms in the past?
Well, I mean, Marco, just think about the events of the last year. The Chinese military has occupied more Indian territory than at any point since the 1962 war that the two countries fought. Due to the stringent lockdown that Modi imposed last March and April, the Indian economy contracted by 25%. And that lockdown actually precipitated a massive internal migrant crisis, the biggest migrant crisis, arguably, since the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947. And yet, Modi's approval ratings, at least judged by the available evidence we have hardly budged.
I'm wondering if there's an up-and-coming leader in India who could exploit Modi's, what critics are saying, is incompetence on the pandemic.
Well, as I mentioned, there were five state assembly elections in India, which just concluded this week. And so the challenge for the opposition really is to cobble together some kind of coalition of like-minded opponents who can project a kind of common platform, a common leadership to try to stop the Modi juggernaut. But we have not seen this kind of opposition coordination to date.
Milan Vaishnav is a senior fellow and director of the South Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's in Washington. Milan, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
It's day 23 of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month of praying and fasting. The traditional dinner at nightfall is called the iftar. It's normally a chance for friends and family to break fast together. But in Spain this year, because of pandemic restrictions, mosques can't host iftar, which has meant a lonely breaking of the fast for many people. For some of them, though, a faith ally has emerged to keep the communal tradition alive. Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
At sunset, a young Muslim man with a microphone leads the traditional call to prayer. Normally, he'd be standing in a mosque. Tonight, he's in a church, a Catholic medieval church called Santa Ana in Barcelona's old city. Rector Peo Sánchez looks on, dressed in his traditional black priest's apparel. They say that challenges always create opportunities, he says. This pandemic has taught us a lot. Pain and difficulties open doors. In this case, the doors to the church's expansive open cloister, a place of peace and of air fresh enough to be exempt from Spain's group dining rules. About 60 men are here tonight. Wary of strangers, many of them don't want to give their full names. Among them is Ahmed, a 36-year-old homeless Moroccan. What am I doing here? He laughs. I'm eating, eating after fasting all day long. On tonight's free menu, lamb soup with chickpeas, boiled eggs, bread, and fruit, served by Catholic volunteers. The idea? It came from Fawzia Chati Badou, head of the Association of Moroccan Women of Catalonia. She says the folks who come are homeless and on their own.
Es triste. Es triste porque este mes es sagrado. Is de familia.
Celebrating iftar on the street would be so sad, she says. This is a sacred month, a time for family. Here we eat like family, as if we were back in Morocco. Back in Morocco, if only for a moment. Then it's back to the streets and reality. There are no jobs, so I can't pay rent anywhere, says a young Moroccan Berber hunched over his tray. He says he gets by collecting scrap metal all day. But with COVID, he says, people are throwing away less and less. The young man finishes up, thanks Rector Sanchez, on his way outside to look for more scrap. He sleeps, he says, under wooden planks in an alley, with one eye open. There are lots of bad people out here, he says. They steal from you. They'll take your bag, your coat, everything. Then he's off with a wave. Says he'll be back for Catholic iftar tomorrow, when he hears the call. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld. From PR.